there. Welcome to We Need to Talk, a weekly podcast that can help empower each of us. And I'm the host, Jane Hasler, a sociologist, mental health professional, and mother of eight, seven sons and one daughter, who range in age from 15 up to 32 years. Each episode, I'll be talking with an expert on a particular social issue, from bullying to climate change, from male violence to ethical behaviour. Knowledge is power, so let's get started. This episode, I'm talking with Australia's leading authority on ethics, philosopher Dr. Simon Longstaff. Simon is the executive director of the Ethics Centre, which he helped establish 30 years ago. His most recent book, Everyday Ethics, discusses how ethics affects our daily lives in both simple and complex ways. In our deeply insightful discussion, Simon explains the differences between values, morals, and ethics, and the importance of examining one's life. He talks about why Socrates is his favourite philosopher, the ethical dilemma his mother faced when he was a young boy of five, and the value of living an ethical life, particularly amongst our leaders. So sit back and enjoy listening to one of Australia's deepest thinkers, Dr. Simon Longstaff. Welcome, Dr. Simon Longstaff, who is the Executive Director of the Ethics Centre. I thought I'd start off, Simon, with asking you how the Ethics Centre came about over 30 years ago. You were the founder, I think, with a couple of other people, possibly, but you were the main founder of it. So what led to it being established, and what are the services it offers?
Well, in fact, it was established before I joined. So I was the first person to work there. So I've effectively had the great privilege of building it pretty much from the ground up. But as a legal entity, it existed. And it came into existence in response to some fairly significant ethical failures in business and professional life during the 1980s. So some people may remember Alan Bond and Christopher Skase and others who were, they were called corporate cowboys at the time. And the then chairman of the National Company and Securities Commission, Henry Bosch, referred to all the lawyers and accountants who had enabled their activities. He described them as the caste of thousands. And so some more conservative people who had really a great sense of the way in which there ought to be integrity infused throughout business looked to see what might be done about this particular problem, because it was certainly Australia's reputation was being adversely affected given the way these people carried on in business. So Sir Vincent Fairfax asked the company secretary of AMP, a man called Meredith Ryan, to look around the world to see what might be done. And Sir Vincent asked Ryan, because he was chairman of AMP, which was a much respected institution back then. And Meredith travelled around, looked around and found a thing called the Trinity Centre, which was based on Wall Street in New York. It was linked to an Anglican church and it had been set up to deal with ethical questions in business. And he came back and, in a really interesting twist of fate, Meredith was also on the parish council of St. James Anglican Church, which is the oldest church in Australia, in King Street in Sydney. And so they'd been looking for a way to play an additional role in Australian society. And so it was this very interesting conjunction with Meredith Ryan as the bridge. There was old school business, Sir Vincent Fairfax, Sir James Baldiston, people like that. There were the old established church that had been there in Sydney since the time of colonisation, Meredith in the middle, and then they brought into existence an organisation which for 25 years, I think, was called St. James Ethics Centre, and it was initially intended to be working on business and professional ethics just in the city of Sydney, but very soon after it started, and certainly when I came back, largely because there was no money to run it, and it's a charity,
right?
We had to start looking at a much broader range of things to do. So the centre today, sorry about that long history.
No, that's what we need.
Yeah. It's the only organisation of its kind in the world. It really is unique.
Wow.
There are other ethics centres, but there's nothing like this. And what distinguishes it is partly the range of matters it deals with. So we can be working with individuals and families on end-of-life decisions about whether to continue with medical treatment or not. We can be drawn into the world of sport, looking at things like the culture of cricket after the ball tampering incident. We can help prepare soldiers to go to war. We can work with anybody, you know, farmers. You just think about anything that people do in their lives across Australia and overseas as well. And the Ethics Centre is bound to have had some involvement. And particularly, we divide our work into two parts. There's what we call shaking the tree, which is drawing attention to really important questions. So things like the Festival of Dangerous Ideas, the IQ2 debates, the publications, the comments we make in the media about things happening in the world, they're all intended to say, hey, this is really important. Let's have a look at it. And then having shaken the tree, we have what we call our catch and carry work. So people fall out of the tree and they say, bump, what do I do now? So we have a counselling service, again, the world's only free national helpline called Ethical for anybody with an ethical issue. And you can be a cabinet minister in the federal government or you can be a policeman on the beat. And this is a safe place to come without any charge.
That's great. And so who answers those calls?
A group of highly trained and well-supervised volunteers for the most part who have got depth of experience in life and they're able to assist people. It's not an advice line in the sense you don't phone up and people say, oh, that's easy, just go and do this. It really is a counselling service which is intended to draw forth from the individuals concerned their own frameworks for judging what they should do and then helping them to see a range of different perspectives. So it's very powerful. It's very well regarded by those who use it. And it's a bit of an undiscovered gem for people there.
Yes.
And then we do occasionally consulting work where people might have had some big issue or they're interested in it. We try and develop new materials. We have the Ethics Alliance, which is almost like a kind of a club for companies and other organisations that are not trying to be perfect. They're just trying to be a little bit better. And so they swap how to do that on ethical issues. The Banking and Finance Oath, which is an initiative to try and improve standards within banking and finance. There's a subsidiary called Primary Ethics, which provides ethics classes for children attending New South Wales State primary schools if they wish to do that, instead of, for example, going off to what used to be called scripture, but special religious education. So it's a pretty broad thing. You know, if you think about, some people will have heard of the Festival of Dangerous Ideas, they'll have no idea the Ethics Centre is involved, or they've heard Primary Ethics, they won't know about that.
Can you explain a little bit about the Festival of Dangerous Ideas?
Yeah, it grew out of a partnership that started with myself and Richard Evans, who was then the CEO of the Sydney Opera House, wanting to do something together. In his case, he was wanting to transform the Opera House into being something more than just a venue for the performance of various arts, you know, opera, drama, things like that. And so we looked at how could you also make it a venue for ideas. And together we came up with this thing called the Festival of Dangerous Ideas, which sounds like a slightly provocative topic, but it was brought into existence for a really serious purpose, which is to resist everybody, whether they're from the right wing, the left wing, wherever they happen to come from, who wants to shut down debate by claiming some superiority in their perspective to the point which they say no one else can do it. So it might be conservatives who say you can't challenge our worldview, or it might be people engaging in what's been called political correctness, where they come, say, from a more progressive view, but they want to cancel people, stop people talking, say we're right, and anybody who questions us must be a bad person. So the Festival of Dangerous Ideas pushes as far as it can at the edges of that sort of tension in order to preserve a middle space where reasonable people can gather. So it's constantly trying to bring into focus matters that really deserve to be discussed, even though in every case we know there'll be some people who'll be outraged by the ideas being proposed.
Yes.
But we think to listen to someone doesn't mean you have to agree to them. Mm. You just have to listen. And so that's what we're trying to do with the festival.
Yes.
FODI, yep, as we call it.
What's it called?
FODI, Festival of Dangerous Ideas.
Of course. Mm. When was it started? When was it started, Simon?
Over a decade ago. Mm. So it's been going for quite a while. Of course, it struggles like all festivals in the current environment with COVID.
Absolutely.
But it's been doing things digitally, which, you know, are a good way to reach, in this case, more people sometimes than you would if you had to have everybody come together in a physical location.
True. Now, you're a philosopher. Can I ask you what led you into the world of ethics? If we can go back to what actually took you on that path. You have a PhD from Cambridge. And very interesting history. When you were 17, you went to Groote Eylandt. That was your first major work. Was that right?
Yeah, my first full-time job.
Yeah. Yeah, after school, and your dad said, okay, you're on your own now, head off to get it, grab a job, and you went to Groote Eylandt. Why Groote Eylandt, which is the fourth largest island, I think, in Australia?
Well, firstly, yeah, you're right. I was still 16, so I finished school when I was 16, and Dad said, well, that's it, you know, basically, because I'd been in boarding school and quite expensive. He said, well, you know, we've given you all the things we're going to give you. So from now on your own. And when you're 16 and don't have any savings, because I'd spent summer holidays and things out in the bush, you know, riding horses and chasing sheep and cutting burrs and things like that, not for pay, but just for board, basically.
Yep.
And when you do that and you suddenly think, okay, you're on your own, what are you going to do? One of the things that was a possibility was to go to a place where wages were high, and that meant mining in one of the most remote places in Australia, because at that time Groote really was genuinely remote. I mean, you didn't have newspapers or radio or television. I mean, if there was television, it used to be a tape that I think came in once a week, and they used to play through a little local broadcaster. We didn't always have a doctor on the island. So it was really like something out of a boy's own adventure. And I didn't turn up there as a person with a big title or anything.
No.
I was 17 and 3 days old on the day I arrived.
Wow.
And I was a cleaner, or what they called a service attendant, but basically a cleaner, emptying bins, cleaning toilets, moving beds and things. But I progressively moved from that into doing, basically I became an emergency services worker. So I had to do courses in emergency care of the sick and injured and all the things that you do if you're back in those days going to become an ambulance driver. And also I did the courses in being a fire officer. So I drove ambulances. In fact, I did my driving lesson, my driving test in a big red fire truck.
Oh,
and I've still got a truck license. I don't have a car license.
All these
years later. So I've kind of carry lots of things from that time, you know, like connection the Indigenous people up there, my kinship ties, my truck license, my knowledge of, you know, basic things to do with human physiology and things, a fantastic range of memories. So that was the starting point. And you might think, oh, that's not really a very probable place to begin, to find yourself in Cambridge and with a PhD in philosophy. But, you know, I think that some of the best philosophical discussions I've ever had were with people who used to work in the mobile maintenance workshop or, you know, rough as guts in some ways, but really interested. And I think what I took from that was that you don't have to be a kind of a formal academic or a person who sort of wraps themselves in obscurity to deal with this, that people of all sorts are really able to deal with quite deep philosophical questions, particularly ethical questions about what ought one to do and things like that. And that's something which should be championed. And I think part of the problem for a lot of philosophy lost its way by, instead of wanting to maintain really strong engagement with the community, it's a bit of a retreat in a sense back into the, you know, the ivory tower.
Yes, yes, of course. Because when you got back to Australia, I think in Martin Place, you set up some chairs.
Oh, from Cambridge.
Yeah, from Cambridge. And you wanted to speak to everybody.
Yeah, it's like, Socrates, my great hero, used to go into what was called the Agora or marketplace and just chat to people going about their day-to-day lives. And I thought that was a really good thing to do. In fact, I actually thought that once I started doing it, there'd be lots of other philosophers finding a little corner somewhere in the public space to put out some chairs. And it was very simple. It was 10 plastic chairs and a cardboard sign which said, if you want to talk to a philosopher about ideas, take a seat.
Whereabouts did you set the seats up?
In Martin Place.
Wow, fantastic.
Yeah, just out what – it was right outside what subsequently became the Lint Cafe, which of course had the terrorist attack.
Mm.
But it was just out there that I used to do. And every time I did it, people would sit down. I mean, the seats would always eventually be full. I did it once every fortnight.
Great.
Rain or shine. Mm. And, you know, people were curious about it, things like that. As it turned out, there weren't a whole lot of philosophers wanting to do it. I spoke to some of the people in the universities and they just scratched their heads. I don't think they understood why I was doing it, or they didn't feel like it was a proper thing for philosophers to do. Anyway, I gave it a go for a number of years and I found it very valuable, and certainly the people who came seemed to enjoy it.
That's fantastic. It reminds me a little bit when I was a kid. I remember in the Domain, my parents used to go
Speaker's
in.
Speaker's Corner.
Yes, yes. Mm. And people would stand up on the box and talk about different issues. Yeah. And they love going in there and listening to that. So you mentioned Socrates. What resonates so much with you about Socrates, a philosopher that was around 400 BC?
Yeah. Yeah. It was a long time ago. He gets a really good rap from Plato. I mean, there's nothing we've got that Socrates wrote himself. So all we know about him is through the works of others. He appears in plays where people make fun of him, and Plato, of course, uses him as a figure. And sometimes it's Socrates' own ideas and sometimes it's Plato's own ideas. But the things that really struck with me were, firstly, as I mentioned, his desire to do philosophy as a practical kind of thing in the public space, his tremendous courage, because they killed him for doing this. I mean, yes. He was accused by the Athenians of impiety and of corrupting youth, which years later I was accused of too.
Oh, really?
Two archbishops both accused me and people like Fred Nile of impiety and corrupting the youth when I was campaigning to have ethics classes made available to children who chose not to go to religious education. And a number of the church leaders hated the fact that something else might be offered in the place of what they were proposing.
Mm.
So it was kind of a badge. I think people like Fred and I probably thought that they were insulting me at the time, but actually they were paying me the greatest compliment ever.
Yes.
And so he did all this not because he knew he would change the face of Western history, as he did, but without knowing that. He did things because he thought it was intrinsically the right thing to do. And so a lot of things today are evaluated according to their impact. You hear about impact investing and impact measurement, as if measuring impact is the way that you validate everything that we could do. But what Socrates showed is that there are some things which are immeasurably valuable that cannot be known to be so at the time. Because on the day he died, executed by his own people, he probably would have said, he could easily have said, "Oh God, what a terrible decision, I've made to be a philosopher. Look what's happened. I've been put to death by my own people. I've been a total failure. Nothing has worked. Maybe I should have given up on philosophy and gone about inventing a better kind of plow or something like that." But he didn't. He stuck to it because he knew that it was intrinsically the right thing to do. And, of course, the vindication is still to be seen thousands of years later. But he couldn't have known that. And so I've always been inspired in part by people like him who find a thing to do which is good in and of itself and are prepared to be brave and wise in doing so. And, of course, then he establishes a pattern that is followed, and you can delve back into it almost endlessly because there's always something to learn. It's very easy to be confused by this man and think that he was just being a smarty pants. But the more you start to understand what he was doing, he was totally genuine when he claimed not to know anything, right? And sought to find out by talking to others. And if others felt that they did know and suddenly they found they didn't, it wasn't because he was trying to prove them ignorant so much as to say, well, let's really go on a journey together and see if we can understand something more about whether it's about love or justice or whatever.
Because he was in Greece, wasn't he? Athens?
Correct.
Yep. Yeah. Plato was his student. Is that right?
It wasn't as if there was a formal school where he sat down and went to classes and lectures.
No.
Plato was taught by Socrates. He saw him. He, in a sense, venerated him as his mentor. Socrates himself, I think he may have been a potter by trade.
Mm-hmm.
He'd been a soldier. There's all sorts of stories about it. They reckon that he could drink almost endlessly without ever getting drunk, that he could stand in one spot for a week. Whatever he was the kind of person who inspired some pretty extraordinary stories. But he wasn't born as an aristocrat. He wasn't rich. He didn't have a life where he was just bequeathed an opportunity for leisure, which he then divided. He actually chose to live this as a kind of life that he thought valuable.
Mm. And, of course, the famous line from him, an unexamined life is not worth living.
Correct.
So we can draw from that that we need to constantly reflect on our lives. We need to examine our lives and what's going on in our community and in our own lives. Is that what we should be taking from that?
I think we should be taking that, but it's also something a bit deeper. And you've got to understand what it is that he's saying. Now, we don't have his notebooks or anything like that, but I think we can work it out by piecing together things that what he knew and what we know of ourselves is that human beings have this remarkable capacity. It may be unique, we just don't know, but we do know of ourselves we have the capacity not merely to be driven by instinct or desire, if you like, our animal nature. That's there, but we're not held prisoner by it. What we can do is we can step beyond it and make conscious choices. Lions, who I always think of as primal, instinctive creatures, get out on the veldt and they hunt an impala or a gazelle. And I very much doubt that lions stop in the middle of the hunt and say, oh, gosh, I'm hungry, but what about its children? Mm. I think they just catch it, they kill it, and they eat it.
Yes.
But human beings every day, and I'm talking about in their millions, will choose not to take something, even though they're starving. And the only thing that will stop them, it's not that anyone will catch them or prevent them. They just say, oh, no, I can't. It's not mine. Or they'll be facing a truly fearsome, terrifying threat, and they'll face it because they promised they would. They won't be defending their own children, their own property or anything. They'll just have said, I promise I will do this, and they'll do it. So this is this remarkable ability to go beyond just instinct and desire. And so what Socrates was saying is that that capacity to examine our life, that ability to go beyond just instinct or desire, says that is what makes us fully human. Yes, you can live that part of your humanity, which is instinct, habit, desire, all those things. But the fully human life, the one which you, where you inhabit the whole of the human house, if you like, rather than leaving a few rooms unlocked and unused, that full human life is the examined life. And he's challenging us, therefore, to live fully in our humanity. So he goes beyond thinking that it's just useful to do, you know, it'll help you best to think before you leap, that kind of thing. He's actually making a very deep claim, which you hear also resonating through religions and other philosophies throughout the ages.
Yeah. We talked about a reason that led you into ethics. When you were in Groote Eylandt, that gave you a real sense of, I guess, justice. With looking at people who were living, the Indigenous people, First Nations people, did that instill in you? But we go back even further, don't we, there? Because I hope you don't mind me bringing up about losing your mum. And she had a huge dilemma, didn't she? Ethical dilemma.
Well, she did, although I didn't know it at the time, and I certainly didn't know it till I was in my 30s, I think.
Yes, I read that. And did that lead you down that path of ethics?
Maybe. It's a bit of a mystery, really. So the situation, for those who don't know, and that will be most people listening to this, my mother came from a very devout Roman Catholic family, and we were all raised in this, and there'd been nuns and priests. The family had produced all sorts of things. And she had three children at the time this dilemma arose, myself, my brother and sister. With me, she'd been perfectly fine, but she'd been unwell in the case of the second and third pregnancy. And she went to the doctor after becoming pregnant for a fourth time. And the doctor said, well, look, Margaret, her name, if you have this baby, you will die. And the baby will probably die too. And so she comes home from that consultation, knowing this, with her religious beliefs and all the rest. And she writes a letter to her sister Anne, my aunt, in which she says, this tells the story of this. She says, look, I've just come back from the doctor. I've been told this is going to happen to me. I have a husband I love and three children already. I love them all. And I sort of feel like if I proceed with the pregnancy, it's almost like committing suicide. But I also believe that this unborn child must have the chance to be baptized. Because remember, at the time she's thinking this, the Catholic Church still believes in limbo, that, you know, the unbaptized souls of the innocent are lost in this kind of netherland. It's not that, I don't think they hold that view now, but that was the case then. And then she says, there's no one I can really talk to about this, you know, who can I chat to? And then she finishes the letter by describing me standing beside her. I must have been colouring in, or I remember I used to try and pretend I was doing running writing, but just doing all these scribbles in journals and things. Now, that's her context, with me standing there with this soul searching going on, wondering where she'd go. And years later, 30 years later, here I am running an organisation which provides precisely the place where a woman like my mother Margaret could come. And I wondered to myself when I found out this letter, one of my aunts, one of these nuns, showed it to me because she had it, whether or not she said something to me as she was, did she make a comment, or did the five-year-old me, or did I just intuit because, you know, mother and child bond, I picked it up. Anyway, it was a pretty remarkable coincidence. And of course, just to finish the story, she did decide to proceed with the pregnancy. She did die a year and a day later, but the child she had, after being in a humidity crib for a very long time, survived and lives to this day.
Wow. I'm so sorry that you went through that.
Well,
how massive is that as a child? Did you know that it was an ethical decision up and you only found out in your 30s when you
I didn't know,
read that letter?
No, I didn't know she had any choice in the matter. I didn't know the background of the pregnancy.
Okay.
All I knew was that she had been sick. And the only ethical dilemma I really experienced of it was when my dad came home on the day she died, and I greeted him in the front where he parked the car, and he came in and he initially said, when I said, how was mum or something like that? He said, she was asleep, because he couldn't bear to tell me. And then later I remember sitting at the end of the bed with, on his knees, he told me, before we told any of the other brothers and sisters, children, that she was actually dead. But he couldn't, you know, his ethical issue was he just overwhelmed by the sadness.
Oh, absolutely.
Do you tell the truth? How do you do it? All the things like that. And so, this is came, but I didn't know it at the time at all. And in fact, I didn't know any of it until I was shown that letter by my auntie.
Really? Wow.
Mm. No one talked about it. You know,
no.
It's just.
No.
Yeah.
No. Wow. COVID. Can I just speak a little bit about our handling of COVID?
Yes.
And I think that has raised a lot of ethical issues here in Australia. It really hit me as a sociologist and a mother of eight, and my mother passed away the year beforehand in 2019 quite suddenly, and I was with her for those 11 days. So at the beginning of last year, it was really shocking me, quite frankly, that people were dying alone. I mean, the new fear was not so much dying as dying alone when COVID hit. And that the research showed that. And I spoke to a couple of epidemiologists at the time where people were dying alone here in Australia. And I said, look, do we have to have this? Can we actually use PPE and have people go into a room? Do you think we're just too quick to follow suit? What's happening overseas? And then, of course, there's been a range of different issues where, if you look at what's been happening in different situations, I believe there could have been more humanity around each situation, say borders stopping people from visiting loved ones, people missing out on funerals of loved ones, and a whole range of different situations. Do you think that sometimes, looking at the way Australia has dealt with it at times, we could have focused a little bit more on the quality of life? Because let's face it, it's a balance, isn't it? By preventing contagion, the whole, what gives life quality is being with loved ones.
Yeah.
So have we thrown the baby out with the bathwater at times? Do you think that we needed to have a bit more of a balance in certain situations?
I think that there's bound to be cases where if people could go back and with the benefit of hindsight, they'd say, surely, why did we not let that happen? The trouble is you don't have hindsight. All you've got at the time are the facts put before you by people who are expert and disinterested, who, in a sense, are not trying to be either particularly kind or cruel. And you've got the prospect that the person dying alone, while that's, I think that's a terribly sad thing that anybody should do that. And that happens all the time because people are left alone, or, you know, I'm even thinking about Indigenous people where they can't even, they're the last person to speak their language and they can't even talk to someone in their own natural language about how they're moving through that process of dying. But you also don't want to be responsible for another avoidable death taking place, where another person, even if they're surrounded by their friends, they don't particularly want to be the person who dies because of an earlier decision made for compassionate grounds in one case, leading to the death of one or more others later on. I mean, that's in a sense, you privilege the compassionate response to one at the expense borne by others who aren't there in the consideration at the time. So it's a really difficult thing to do. Plus also, you've got to avoid creating any sense that exceptions are being made for a few, while others are having to bear the full weight of the burden of public safety and things. And that's why when politicians or the powerful or the wealthy are given special privileges, or appear, even if it's within the rules, technically speaking, they seem not to understand the symbolic significance of this for a community that says, well, we've had to have all those terrible things like not seeing mum die or whatever it was. How come they got to do it? Or how come they got the special treatment? So it takes the wound and it makes it even more raw. So I'm unable to give like the answer to the question in every case because I'm just not across all the facts in the moment. All I can say is that as a matter of principle, we need to have a care and concern for our humanity and the humanity of others to the greatest extent that is consistent with also ensuring people are safe and not exposed to an avoidable risk. And one of the terrible tragedies in all of this was that at the beginning, and until quite recently, we had just one single measure that could boost safety, particularly for the vulnerable, and that was isolation, lockdown. Prior to the vaccines being available, and even when they were notionally available and they actually weren't practically available, we couldn't do anything about it. I mean, lots of things we could do about mental health if we wanted to put investment in it, lots of things we could do about economic difficulties, but only one thing to protect people, and that was the lockdown. And so that's why I think we went where we did, made it as clear. And of course, you've also got the political dimension that if any politician makes a compassionate exception, which is then the source of the next round of infection. I mean, imagine the case where a person says, oh, there's one case where we'll make an exception and PPE will do, and that becomes the case that causes a subsequent reinfection and a lockdown of a whole city or something. I mean, just, that's such a, I think the point to your question is maybe what we need to reflect on is whether or not our commitment to humanity and the kind of cases you describe is sufficient to forgive others who, in the name of that humanity, make choices that we prefer they didn't. In other words, would we forgive a prime minister or a premier who allowed that one person to go and see their dying parent if that person then causes a whole city to be locked down? Will we forgive them for that? Or are we going to do, is our concern for our own well-being and our interests and all the other things so great that we would discount that as being a bad decision?
But I guess the argument that some people have come up with and that I was feeling was that each individual situation, we need to keep humanity at the forefront and to be saying, well, how can we make this happen? Sometimes I'm wondering whether Australia just took this hardline approach and we could have used PPE or put people in. When I spoke to some epidemiologists, they said, yes, there are ways to do it. And rather than have this broad way of doing things, a hard line way of doing things, we could have looked at each individual situation in a more humane way.
Well, I think that's I think that's the ideal. You want to have every situation, but the thing is that you've got to be practical too, in the sense that you've got to take into account, is the time there, the resources to make available tailor-made situation solutions for every situation, or do you risk by making a tailor-made exception for this person as opposed to that, causing resentment amongst those who fall outside the particular case that was approved on this occasion? And they say, hey, Jane got to do it, but why not me? There's so many variables in this that you can understand why somebody said, actually, we're going to set a general standard which has to be applied. This is an old problem about rules in general. We'll set a rule when, in fact, sometimes it's much better to have a principle. But, of course, the other thing is people want certainty. I mean, I can live with a fairly high degree of uncertainty. I sort of like it.
Me too.
But I've learned over the years that there are some people who are crushed by the uncertainty. They want to know where the bright line is drawn. And so there will be a certain percentage, perhaps even a majority of people who say, tell me the rule. Tell me the standard. I can't cope with this case-by-case thing. And so that probably factored in too. Now, all I can say in relation to that is my preference would be that you look at the individual circumstances, that you apply the minimum burden that is actually necessary. But I also have to be alive to the practical realities of this and the expectations of a community that in many cases desires the certainty that only comes with a rule.
I saw you giving a talk, Simon, where you said people do need that certainty. However, sometimes they'll latch on to certainty, which they don't necessarily agree with, but it's something they can follow. But if we give an argument that, yes, this can be done in this situation and explain it to them, then they will understand. And we sometimes, I think, in a way, insult our people, our community, by saying this is the way it is, and they're going, well, hold on, can't we do it this way? And we need to actually give them the right argument and let them know, because I think a lot of people were saying, well why? Why can't we do this? Why can't we cross that border and do it in a safe way to see a loved one dying, etc.?
As I mentioned to you at the beginning, you know, we're sitting around in Groote Eylandt with people, you know, chatting. I think our politicians, for example, grossly underestimate the capacity of the Australian people to recognise a good argument. And part of the problem about this question about the balance between a general rule and the particular circumstances of an individual, their family and so forth, is that it wasn't necessarily well enough explained as to why there was this general rule. And so people say, well, surely they can make an exception for me, or can't they see how much I'm suffering, or mum's suffering, or dad or grandpa or someone like that? And they just need to have one hold their hand. And you know, you hear these terrible stories, you know, the ones about even where they were allowed in with PPE. They're sitting there and the person's inside a kind of like a tent and they can't touch them, hold their hands. I mean, in some senses that may have been crueler than not being there in front of it. Who knows? I mean, it will vary from person to person.
It's funny because it only being less than a year when my mother died and I was with her every night for 11 nights, I said to my husband, I would have, if they told me I couldn't be with mum for whatever, I would have just, I know that I probably would have stood there and screamed, maybe metaphorically, maybe not. But it is so tough to have to accept that.
Yeah, and there may have been others too who would have said, to have to stand and watch your mum die inside this fully enclosed tent with you there, unable to have any touch at all, a word or anything. I mean, I'm not saying that there's one or right. I'm just saying that human beings, the thing that they need or in those moments can vary so much from person to person that, yes, you could do that. I know for a fact that I don't think adequate attention was given to the particular reasons for some of the rules that were made. And also there's this problem too, as I mentioned, about double standards. I mean, if it's a politician telling you, when they are able to be given exceptions, which seem, you know, to work, it makes it pretty tough for the rest of people to say, well, you want us to be strictly accountable for obeying the rules, but you're not. And I'm not here just talking about COVID rules. I'm talking about the fact that, generally speaking, in Australia now, our political culture has become one in which senior politicians are never actually responsible for anything they do. And they're responsible for the good stuff, but when they do something bad, they run a million miles and they're not really held to account for it. And that, I think, just annoys people.
Of course. Well, hopefully that will be changing soon with the Federal Integrity Commission being set up. Mm. What's your thoughts about an integrity where people in Parliament and government need to be held accountable for their actions?
Well, we don't know what it's going to be yet. I mean, the government has said they'll put legislation forward before the end of 2021, but as yet we haven't seen the model. But they keep saying things that make me think it's not really going to be effective. For example, even the most recent comments from ministers are saying, oh, well, we're only going to deal with criminal corruption. Well, what's criminal? I thought all corruption was criminal. But anyway, if it's not, but it does mean then that you get a government that says, oh, well, we'll define what counts as criminal corruption. They're the only things you can look at. And they could leave out a whole lot of things. Like, for example, they might say, well, if we take $500 million of taxpayers' funds and use it to boost our election results, in other words, they use it for a private purpose to advance a political interest, they might say that's not criminal corruption, therefore it can't be looked at. They'll say that's just politics. Well, if an integrity commission can't look into that, we're sunk. And my fear is that that's probably the sense of what they're going to do. Although I've got to maintain a degree of skepticism in my own mind about my thoughts because we haven't seen it. So maybe I'm jumping at shadows, which we'll only really know once they reveal their proposed model.
Okay, right. It's just going back to COVID, it will be interesting to have an inquiry. They will be having a commission into investigating how best it was handled or how it could have been better handled or in any situation. I think that is going to be very insightful, the results from that, in case it could happen, another pandemic occurs and we are better prepared. I mean, the hotel quarantine.
It's not a question of it could, it will happen. I mean, human beings throughout history have been slain in the millions in some cases by pathogens. So this is not the first, it won't be the last pandemic. And if we weren't going to try and learn from it, well, wouldn't we be mugs? But
yes,
we've got a golden opportunity to do that, and hopefully the lessons will be there. The only thing we've got to watch out against is that we don't let the lessons of the past limit our imagination and our response in the future. I mean, you can become, it's a bit like, you know, where you become the world's best dinosaur just at the time when everything's moving to the age of the mammals. Not a great achievement if you're the best dinosaur just when dinosaurs have no role left.
No.
So we've got to look back, learn, but also be open to the possibility that the new challenges will require new responses.
Yeah, and there's nothing more valuable than the lived experience, hearing from a range of people about how different situations affected them. So just wanting to talk about a few different issues in Australia. I believe that Australia in many ways needs a humanity overhaul. When you look at a couple of different areas, a voice to Parliament with recognition in the Constitution for our Indigenous people, when you look at the way we still treat asylum seekers, we've still got a number that are offshore on Nauru and Manus, and in mandatory detention, community detention, TPVs, and we've still got people living in poverty, homelessness, and our punitive justice system as well. I sort of look at it and I think we need a humanity overhaul there in so many ways, and I'm wondering, where do you think a lot of this punitive approach comes from? Do you think it stems a lot from our colonisation from England and Europe, and we haven't looked at the way other things are done elsewhere in a far more humane way? Say, look at the Scandinavian countries. What's your feeling about where we're sitting at the moment in relation to humanity?
Well, I think it's a divided picture. I mean, one of the problems is that people can be genuinely motivated by a humane intent and it can lead them to do some pretty inhumane things. So I don't doubt that at least some of the people, for example, who were worried about those heading off to sea sent by people smugglers and things like that to come to Australia and drowning out there, there are some people who looked at that and saw in it a political opportunity, and that sort of drove them to say, oh, well, let's get tough on borders. There are also some people who genuinely were appalled by the loss of life and the sight of children and others drowning at sea, because they'd paid a whole lot of money to people who didn't care about their lives and just sent them out in these vessels, which were always going to founder, hoping that someone would just pick them up to let. And we don't know how many around the world, particularly in the Mediterranean, have been lost to drowning because of that pernicious trade. So you can understand that there may be amongst some of the people who said, oh, let's stop that from happening, a really genuine intent to act in a humane way. But the means they then employ can be as bad as the thing that was there. You know, it doesn't seem that there was enough imagination or commitment of resources to make it unnecessary. And of course, when it comes to that particular case, the best thing you can do is to make people's homes places where they can live in safety and prosperity, because no one really says, like, you know, wake up and we say, oh, let's just head off to Australia by the most difficult way possible. They would much have preferred to stay if they could. And it's true with homelessness and a whole lot of different issues. So I don't always think it's right to start by thinking there's a lack of humanity as the root source. Some people don't care. I mean, they're just selfish. They look after themselves. They don't give much of a stuff about anyone else. But there are plenty of people who care but are rather hapless or inadequate in the way they respond to their care. And they may be so convinced in the rightness of their prescription about what to do that they sort of say, oh, well, I've done a good thing now. I don't have to look anymore. I don't have to notice the unintended consequences or the harm befalls those that are subject to the prescription being applied. And so somehow or other we've got to give a chance to people, everybody who has good intentions, to pause for a moment, check the nature of the policy. And one of the best ways to do that is to ask the people concerned who are being affected. I mean, one of the great cries that comes from our First Nations people is, why don't you just talk to us? Why don't you ask about this? I mean, you turned up, there were these wars, people fighting on both sides, massacres on both sides, mainly visited upon the Indigenous people. But we fought these wars and we've got there, you know, you didn't rub us out, we're still here, all these other things have happened. And we want to give you something, a gift about how to belong in this country, but you just won't talk. You think you know, just ask. Mm. And so I think if you were to draw some general principle out of this is, we firstly, let's not presume ill will. Let's start with the fact that there's a fair dose of goodwill, but there's an inadequate response. And maybe the best response to that is to engage with those who you think you're trying to help and ask them what would really help and not be indifferent to the unintended consequences of your own actions.
Mm. But taking that action and making the changes, say, for instance, voice to parliament, Indigenous voice to parliament with recognition in the constitution, having a referendum, that is actually saying we are serious about this rather than the continual talks. I mean, the jury's come back, hasn't it, on the answer that we do need voice to parliament with recognition in the constitution to fully respect our First Nations people, and that is what they've been arguing for a long time.
But even those who believe in that, you know, there's a divided view about the tactics. So there are some people who have got, this is within Indigenous, you know, First Nations people, who've got absolutely no doubt that this is what should be done. But they think the soul of the nation would be broken if you had a referendum in which it was defeated. And so they so say, well, what do we need to do first to get to this thing where people can say yes and we can resolve this? I mean, just imagine if you had a referendum and it fell short. I mean, we'd just feel so, well, some might not care, some might celebrate that, but people like me, I'd feel so desolate that we'd not manage to make the case. So I think you've got to think about this as, I mean, I'm thinking about the people right in the centre of this debate who are the advocates for change, including the people who wrote the Statement from the Heart and things like that. What's been more troubling was the way in which the initial statement was just rejected out of hand without any debate. That to my mind, is the strange and perplexing thing. It's not that people might say, oh, well, how do we go about it in the best way, but to say, no. No thought, no respectful response. That was that was the darker moment in that, not the fact that people were trying to work out how to do it. And I think it really affected a lot of people very badly to see something which had been so carefully crafted, so generously expressed, just given the flick.
And to be told an argument that didn't make any sense, that it would be a third chamber in Parliament. It didn't make any sense. It was crazy stuff.
It was whatever the reason was. The point is, within what, hours? Was it a day or something? It was just, you know, and it was the Prime Minister too who was doing it, saying, no, out you go, flick.
So I think it's so important, isn't it, to show the community that we care from the government level, from our leaders. Do you think the fact that they haven't taken action on, say, a voice to Parliament with recognition, that they haven't, they still have hardline policies with those seeking asylum, because we still ethically should not be using people as guinea pigs to try and prevent people smugglers. I mean, we can be doing that a different way by having a surveillance around Indonesia. I mean, people are still leaving the shores. They're just not coming to Australia because we're turning them back. So there's a much more humane way to be dealing with this. And it's not surprising that Australia is looked upon internationally as lacking humanity in many ways. What's your opinion on that?
I don't know how people see us. I think our reputation for our humanity has suffered, but it's probably suffered around things like environmental credentials, you know, this notion of a nation of moderately decent people and things like that. I think people look at our policies and practices and they question. But you take something like asylum. I mean, I think this is one of the things where you really need to go back to basic principles to work out what to do. Asylum is a promise of safety, not prosperity. No one seeking asylum is guaranteed that they're going to end up, you know, in the land of milk and honey. They flee from oppression, persecution, a whole lot of things, and the only thing that they ask for is safety. And we are obliged internationally to provide safety for those who seek asylum. Now, once you get that clear in your mind, it's a very simple question. Are the conditions on places like Nauru and formerly on Manus Island, are they safe? Or are they making people unsafe? Because if you have people being driven to commit suicide or under threat from whatever, if it's not safe, it fails the very, very basic test. And you don't have to necessarily be wound up into a question about, are we more or less humane than the past and the present or this group or that? You just have to go to the very simple point that the thing which you are obliged to offer is not being delivered, that you're failing even under the terms you say you accept. And that, once you get to that point, then I think you start to unravel a lot of these things and say, well, what, you know, you see the commitment, as I say, it's a limited one, but it cannot be discharged under the conditions so far, which we've seen applied.
Well, when I worked in mental health as a mental health registered nurse years ago, I looked after a lot of asylum seekers from Christmas Island, and I could see the immense distress that was being caused.
Well, it's not safe, is it? They weren't safe.
No. The mental health issues that were unbelievable and people who suicided, absolutely. Now, I just wanted to talk about ethics itself. People can sometimes get a little bit confused about ethics, morality, principles, but they're all tied into each other, aren't they?
Well, they're all related, but they're all different. So I'll give you a very, very quick distinction. So the core question of ethics, which Plato ascribes to Socrates, about whom we were speaking before, is what ought one to do? Not to think or to feel, but to do. So it's practical. And it's practical in the sense that once you decide what you ought to do, you are expected to do it, not just say that was very interesting and go off and do something completely different. What ought one to do, rather than you, me, we, they, is to give a sense that what should any person who is in relevantly similar circumstances do? Now, when they seek to answer this question, very practical question, down to earth, every day, from what you go and buy at the shops, from what you do in an end-of-life situation, I say, well, how are we going to answer it? And they say, well, one thing we know about human beings is if you give them a free choice, an unconstrained choice, they'll choose the thing which they think is good or better. So if you put a couple of apples and oranges on the table, there are four choices, and only four choices. You can have an apple, an orange, You can have both or you can have none. That's your four choices. So if a person picks up the apple, you say, well, they think that's good. They think it's better than these other choices. And the moment you understand the basic logic of that, then the question becomes, well, what is good then? What is better? That's what values are. When somebody says, these are my values, these are the things that I say are good, those are the things which will direct my choices. But how do I get the things that are good? Do I steal the apple? Do I wait for it to be permission? Do I take it when somebody else wants it? Do I cut it in half? How you get the things that are good is defined by a second thing, which is about what is right. And from that question come principles. So values show you what's good, what's worth taking. Principles explain to you a framework for how you get the things that are good. So let's suppose one of your values is harmony. You could get harmony by killing everybody who disagrees with you. The resulting land is perfectly harmonious. But there'd be a principle that says you shouldn't do that. It might be do unto others as you would have them do unto you, or only do the things you'd be proud to see in the full light of day. There's a range of these. All cultures throw them up. So ethics, with its core structure, has this question: what ought one to do? What is good? What is right? And from that become values and principles. Now, we talked before about an ethical life being an examined life. And that is where the difference lies between an ethical life and a moral life. You can have a morality which has got values and principles. In the case of religious moralities, there are also exemplary lives, revealed truth, scriptures, and sorts of things like that. But they've all got values and principles. And you can live a moral life in which you take your values and principles and you simply apply them because you've been told to by the religious authorities, or because you've been raised that way, or because it's become a set of habits. But in a sense, you don't have to think about it too much. You might be habitually generous or truthful. Whereas an examined life, an ethical life, you always have to think about it. So the higher life, a moral life, might be good enough. We might say we prefer a moral life if it means that people are kind and generous and all those things. But to go back to Socrates, we would say that yet isn't quite the kind of life for a human being. A human being will not merely act as a matter of habit, even if those habits are virtuous. They will examine it. They will know why they do it. They will reflect on their practice.
Mm. But do you think that's dropped off a little bit, where people are not examining their lives? Maybe with the rise of technology, has there been a correlation there?
It's not really dropped off. It's never been popular. An examined life, there's not really been any point in history where a majority of people have embraced it and said, that's great. Most people throughout most of history have been content to live a moral life, where they've accorded with the teachings of the church or the state or whatever. Most people have been perfectly happy to follow the habits of a lifetime because they help them get along. Most people live with institutions which are never questioned, where they just say, why do you do what you do? Because that's just the way things are done around here. Because everybody does it. That is the dominant strain within humanity. It's why you kill Socrates, because he challenges that. I don't think we are less ethical now than other ages. There's no kind of golden age where everybody was sitting around deeply reflective. It's always been a fringe activity. But the fact that it's never been dominant doesn't mean it hasn't always been the pinnacle for a good human life. It's just it's a difficult life to live. And so people would often prefer simple certainties or adhering to the dictates of those who are powerful or influential, rather than going through the work of having to think for yourself.
Yes. So it's sometimes having a moral life, whilst good in many ways, it's also taking the easier way out, isn't it? I don't have to make the decisions myself. Yeah. This is what is being dictated to me, so I'll follow that. So when you look at some of the great leaders like, Abraham Lincoln, Gandhi, a lot of them were following more an ethical life because it was very different to what so many of the populace were following themselves.
And all of them get killed for it. Gandhi, Lincoln. So look, it's not everyone, but it's not the most popular or easy thing to do, because a leader who embraces ethics is going to challenge the unthinking custom and practice of the age. They're the person who's going to say, why are we doing this? What is it about slavery? And will call attention to the fact that it's hypocrisy on the part of a nation that claims to believe in the fundamental equality of all. And people hate it, because most people want an easier life, which gives them the comfort of the Koran moral framework or the legal structure without necessarily having to think for themselves. Imagine, you know, that sounds pretty exhausting, and it can be, if you have to take full responsibility for the choices that you engage and the world that you make as a result of it. But that is the ethical life, and it's a wonderful life. You don't, the thing about it also is you don't have to be perfect. You just have to be slightly better each day.
That's right. That's right. And when you look at some of our great leaders here in Australia, John Curtin, Gough Whitlam, who made a lot of changes. I mean, John Curtin, during the war years, he died in office. In some ways, him living the ethical life killed him because, you know, he died young at 60, heart failure. And then Gough, well, look what happened to Gough Whitlam in the end. But in those 2 years he was in, he did so much good stuff. Do you think we just need more leaders around that are not – do you think there's too many career politicians in our government where they're just looking after themselves, they're not thinking about the community? A good leader really will be somebody that tells people that this is something that will be good for you. You won't think it at the moment, but it will end up being good for you.
Well, I suppose, you know, John Howard did that with the GST, you know, where he was prepared to take that to an election. I think you find people of this kind – who will have certain core beliefs which they're prepared to take risks for right across the political spectrum. Bob Brown, you know, when he was doing stuff in the environmental movement and later with the Greens. I mean, they're all there to be found, but they tend to be rarer than the people these days who are becoming really expert in the machine and how to run the political machine without necessarily knowing what it's for in a deeper sense.
Why do you think that's the case?
Well, look at it. I mean, a lot of people these days will enter into politics through a kind of fairly well-worn path. They'll maybe a union official, work in a parliamentary office, be part of this, or they might be, I don't know, whatever the equivalent is on the Liberal side. And some time ago, certainly, you know, decades ago, there were a lot more people who didn't do that. They might have been working in a job. They might have been, you know, people like me, cleaners and things, and they sort of worked their way through, or train drivers like Chifley. Or they'd been to the war, they'd had to sort of rub shoulders together with all types. So they'd done stuff that gave them a grounding in the community. Whereas if you come through this professional political class where you are trained to be adept in how the machinery of politics works, how to get this and that, then the machinery becomes the thing which dominates rather than the purpose. And in that sense, it might make things more efficient, but I'm not sure that we're better off for that particular trajectory.
No, because in a way, having experience in life in other areas can bring so much richness to your position in politics, and you can understand things from a broader perspective. Would you argue that one?
Well, I think that's pretty obviously true. I mean, and also you're going to relate to a different group of people, not just those who are part of that class that contends for power.
That's right. Is there anything that you're feeling in your position with the Ethics Centre? You've been the executive director for 30 years now. Have you seen changes there, Simon, over those three decades? Is there anything that stands out that you'd like to say being the executive director of the Ethics Centre?
Yeah, well, it's not so much the past, it's the future, which I'm focused on. We are about to encounter what I think will amount to civilizational change. It's not just the geopolitical environment, but it's the introduction of new technologies, AI, robotics, biotech, some things which will challenge our definition of what it means to be human. We could become, because of our vast amounts of clean energy, natural resources, we could become the most prosperous nation the world has ever known. But that prosperity will not be produced by humans. That'll be produced by machines that work 24 hours a day, 7 days a week. And that will be the source of our economic wealth. But that's not the world we live in. At the moment, you have this ridiculous claim where it's said that everybody needs a job to live a meaningful life. It wasn't true in ancient Athens. It wasn't true for the indigenous people of this land. They didn't have jobs in any sense. And I'm concerned that we're about to have this major change visited upon us without any preparation for it, without any real sense of how to make a transition to completely new models, for how we raise revenue, how we distribute it, how we organise our time. Deciding there's a difference as there is between work and a job. Plenty of people have very valuable work. They don't necessarily have a job in the sense that they're doing it. And all of that is before us, and it could be the most remarkably beneficial time. But it could also be destroyed by our inability to anticipate it and address it adequately by bringing forward the kinds of questions it will give rise to and engaging the community in a conversation and providing with a sense of confidence that it's going to be well managed and it's going to be just and orderly as we unfold these opportunities. So that's what I think is the more interesting thing, less so than what has emerged over changes in the past, which are as nothing compared to where we're heading.
Mm. And how can we help guide that? Just finishing up, how can we help guide it in a positive direction rather than it going in
start
a negative?
Start talking about it. Mm. Start talking about it. Start being honest about what's coming. Start engaging our moral imaginations. What would it be like? How would we organise things where lots of people will lose their jobs because machines do them better? How do we make meaningful lives for all those people? How do we sustain it economically? How do we redesign our cities and suburbs? What's the new model? Do those with jobs come home and find a beautifully cooked meal from their neighbour next door using ingredients grown by someone down the street? You know, that, who knows? The point is we could invent, as humans have throughout time, new models that adapt to the circumstances, but we won't do it if we just leave it to accident alone. Or if we do, it'll be just lucky accidents. I'd rather think about it first.
Absolutely. And that's the ethics, isn't it? Having an examined life to be focusing on our actions and our attitudes, all of that. It'd be great if we had an ethics centre, I think, sitting in Parliament or, you know, down there in Canberra.
Well, that's one of the biggest things to be done, really. I mean, we're focusing a lot on an integrity commission, which is about probity. I think an equal challenge is how do you equip our members of parliament with the ethical literacy and skills to deal with this complexity? That's a challenge worth rising to.
Absolutely. And look, that's a great way to finish up. Thank you so much, Simon, for your time today. I really appreciate it.
Thanks, Jane.
Next week, I'm talking with one of Australia's leading historians, Professor Mark McKenna, on why Australia needs to have an Indigenous voice to Parliament with recognition in our Constitution. We also discuss why Australia needs to become a republic and how these two causes are intimately linked. I hope you'll join us for this illuminating discussion, and until then, take care of yourselves and each other, and remember, knowledge is power.